Good morning. I'm going to call the meeting of the House Ag Policy Committee to order, and the clerk will note those who are present. We have a quorum. We are continuing on with House File 151, which Representative Hansen, who was here just a second ago, I should have looked to see, but he's will be here to present. Perhaps we will do the minutes. Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the minutes of the February 7th, 2013 minutes.
The minutes have been moved for February 7th. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, no. The motion prevails that the minutes are approved. And I think we will have people from, I think we do have Dean Durgan on the list, but I'm not sure if Representative Hansen, I did not.
Madam Chair, I think he ran up to his office to get a couple materials, so he should be back shortly.
Okay, thank you. Only a thank you. Arlen, our very able page, has asked me to ask you if you each have House File 151 in your file. And we didn't put it in the current folder. It would have been in the one that you would have saved. So if you did not save it, he just wants to know so he can make copies. So we have, so just if you raise your hand, if you did not save it and need a couple, I would say maybe if you can bring back about four copies. Thank you, Arlen. It's so helpful to have good staff.
Yes. He's the best.
He is. I know. I'm
a role model for the rest of us.
Absolutely. Representative Hansen.
I had to refresh my coffee.
Oh, please don't tell me that was the reason. We have already begun the meeting, and if you would, please, you can continue presenting House File 151.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for being a little bit late. I wanted to start off this morning because I think we weren't able to get into some of the detail, and I do have folks here from the University of Minnesota who can talk about the training manuals, and I want to maybe step back and look at kind of the high altitude value view of where we're at. Pesticide applicator training and licensing were set up many years ago with kind of a division of responsibility and authority. That division of responsibility and authority is the Department of Agriculture is designated as a lead agency. They are the regulatory body. And then in every state, there's a land-grant institution that's designated as the training or the certification, the folks that are responsible for that type of education and training. And those two folks work together, but the educational part doesn't become regulatory, but the regulatory part approves the education. That makes sense. And so what the bill does, what 151 does, our mechanism, and we've talked some about the financing, but our mechanism is that the Department of Agriculture is and has been designated as the lead agency for pesticide applicator regulation in the state of Minnesota. The past 25 years, primarily since the Groundwater Act of 1989, the pesticide law has remained fairly constant. At that time, there were changes that added water quality, groundwater protection, kind of into the training component. Also at that time, the federal government designated certain pesticides, and at that time it was herbicides such as Alachlor or atrazine as restricted use pesticides. So when they became restricted use pesticides, then the farmers had to get a private pesticide certification. And that program has been working for many years. Last meeting, we distributed a number of manuals, and you should be getting a copy this morning of the commercial, non-commercial, structural applicator study form. I think there's been some confusion about where some of the responsibility and authority has rested and where some of the payment has been for these programs. And I'm going to stay on the commercial, non-commercial, structural applicators. These are folks who are applying pesticides for hire. They're the folks who will apply pesticides for hire in this building. They are people who will apply pesticides for hire on the lawn out in front of the Capitol. They're the folks who, if there's a rotenone treatment for carp in a lake, they're the folks who do that. And so we have to demonstrate through education and a measurement tool of an exam, the regulation port component, that the applicator, the person, has met minimum competency. And minimum competency is what's in the manual. The manual is the content that the applicator studies. The exam is what they take to demonstrate that competency. If it's not in the manual, it can't be on the exam. If the manual's out of date, then the exam's out of date. And that whole thing potentially jeopardizes and affects the system we have for pesticide regulation if we cannot demonstrate current minimum competence. If there's litigation on pesticides, you're going to come back to the training and certification of the applicator. Did the person know what they were doing? Have they demonstrated that they've known what they're doing? Have they been updating their competency if they've been an applicator for a long time? So if I take a test, if I go take that test with the commercial, non-commercial, and structural applicators, they're taking a closed book exam. And that exam has multiple questions. It's a multiple choice exam. But with the structural pest control applicators, they actually identify insects. So there's an actual insect identification part of that exam. So making sure the exam is sound is also a responsibility of the Department of Agriculture. They have to pre-test that test with applicators. They have to make sure the questions are good. They have to structure the questions that they're sound. It's because everything has to be legally defended. The exam's written to the manual. The manual has to be sound and current. The exams have to be current to the manual. So the cost that comes up is not just printing the manuals. The cost is involved in making sure that the manuals and the exams are legally defensible, that the content is accurate, that it's a good test, so that when a person takes the test, they're demonstrating that they know that minimum competency. Once they become licensed, after demonstrating that minimum competency, we require that they continue to upgrade their knowledge. So we require, at different intervals of time based on what the category is, we require that they go to workshops or continuing education training. Now, over the years, those workshops have changed. When I was in the program, and I would go around the state with some of the folks that are in the room, we would spend January through April pretty much on the road training, going out all around the state. We'd go to Morris, We would be going to Worthington. We would be going around the state conducting continuing education workshops to demonstrate, and we'd have to, applicators would have to prove that they're there. They would have to prove that they've been going to those workshops to continue to get licensed. The workshops are paid for by the applicators or their companies, that continuing education workshop. The manuals are a cost recovery for the university as well. The workshop money, the applicator money, does not go to the Department of Agriculture. That goes to the University of Minnesota. The money that's collected right now in the system we have right now to pay for those programs. Over time, there have been changes in, I guess what I would call our portfolio of applicators. It used to be primarily agriculture. It used to be categories C and D. Those have been combined to one agricultural herbicide and insecticide category. Those are the folks who, if you're a farmer and you hire them to come out and spray your field, they've demonstrated their minimum competency by taking an exam after studying the manual, and then they go to workshops year after year after year. They pay a license fee year after year after year. Over time, as things have changed and there's been changes in the chemistry, changes in the industry, changes in the structure of how things are done in the world of pesticide application, you've had changes where you have more turf applicators. So what will happen here in the next few weeks is the Chemlons, the turf and ornamental companies, will start hiring people. They'll start interviewing people, and they've got to get them to get a manual, to get studied, to take the test before they can go out and apply. And we're dealing with hundreds of people that will move through the system. Many of those applicators now are younger. This might be a summer college job. Many of them may speak a different language. And they may not be choosing this as a career. Some may. Some may come back summer after summer and do this. But they're demonstrating their competency by taking the test after studying the manual. We've also had, as certain pesticides have become restricted use pesticides, or if they've become of certain greater regulatory concern, new categories created. These categories may be specific use, like antimicrobial use. We created in Minnesota that category, I believe, in 2007, responding to concerns after floods, where people were coming in, people have been flood affected, they've got mold in their home, and somebody's coming by and saying, we'll spray your home for mold. Well, we want to make sure that if someone's coming into your home and spraying your home for mold, that they have competency. So again, a manual's developed, you have an exam, and you're demonstrating that people have competency to apply those pesticides properly. There are other smaller categories, sewer root control, the pocket gopher. Some of those smaller categories are there because the pesticide impact or the concerns for having that higher level of education rather than just going and buying it and applying it, but having a competency that you are applying it for higher safely, those pesticides are not ones of environmental concern. They're of concern for personal protection for the applicator. So you want to demonstrate, you want the applicator to demonstrate that they can read that label, and the label for that pesticide shows the safety measures that must be taken. Some are very specific as to, for this pesticide, you must wear this type of glove. You can't just go buy one off the shelf. You must wear this type of glove to protect your hands, or you must wear a certain personal protective equipment that is specific to that type of pesticide. So it becomes more detailed. With those smaller categories, the manuals don't have a lot of applicators. But the applicators who are making those applications may be having an exposure that they need to make sure that they're applying things properly. So why are we here? I've talked with many of you on both sides of the aisle that you have, you're somewhat in agreement on that we need to update the manuals. There's disagreement on how this should be funded. Some think it should be funded one way, some should think it should be funded the other way. We will be, if this bill makes it out of committee and goes to fiscal committee, I can assure you that the funding mechanism will be different than what's in the bill, because we may not need 5 years of 0.1%. I think you'll hear from the university today that the exact cost estimates of what it takes to create a manual. But I want to be clear that the cost of the manual aren't just printing a new manual. It's all of the involvement to make sure that the manual is sound. And then it is to make sure that the exams are sound. And that's where cost, and cost is variable. So we're operating on some of those estimates. I've talked with many of you about these cost issues. Between now and the next committee, I think we'll work on that. We'll be getting some specific details on those cost estimates, and I am pretty confident that those will be changing. But there will be a cost. I want to be assured there is a cost for doing this right. I think we have a good system. Now, it's been 8 years since I've been directly involved in this system, but I've kept touch with the agencies, and I've kept touch with applicators. I've heard from lawn care folks that are in my district. There are structural pest control people in my district. There are folks in all of our districts that are certified or licensed applicators. And so we have a good system now. What I'm asking is that we invest in that system to make it great, that Minnesota can be a kind of a star in terms of the best applicator manuals, the best training materials, the best exams, that our applicators are the best in the country. And the way to do that is to make these investments. I commit to you, I do not have any other bills that I want to attach to this pesticide bill. I do not intend for the fee as it is in the bill now would be gone after 5 years. I don't intend that this is a long-term project. I don't want anyone to come back in 5 years and say, let's just absorb this fee and keep charging it. My intent is to focus on these manuals and focus subsequently on the exams to update them so we have the best that we can have. Any questions?
And Representative Hansen, yes, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chairman, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for presenting this. I think all of us, including me, really would like to see us have a great program for certification and training, and I don't think that's a question here. I think the question that you bring before us is how do we pay for the updating materials to make it certain? And just as you've said earlier, we do have ongoing creation of new chemicals and new procedures that are going to be doing this, and so I'm concerned about the long-term availability of funding for creating those new materials. And it seems to me that we also have another licensing program that we're all very much aware of that doesn't use taxing as a way of funding those materials. You know, when we get our driver's license and we have new materials made, we don't tax car sales or gasoline tax or whatever directly in order to absorb those costs. We really do expect that the costs are at least partially absorbed by those fees that we pay when we renew our license, and then there may be appropriations that may be directly for that piece. Now, if I remember what you said earlier, you said the University of Minnesota gets the dollars for the workshops itself, and so that they're getting all the dollars, and no dollars go to the Department of Ag, if that's what I heard you say. My question is, who are you envisioning would be the organization, the agency, that will be creating these new materials if it's not the University of Minnesota? And if it is the University of Minnesota, then why can't they just absorb those costs within the fee structure that we have?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Petersburg. And I enjoyed meeting with you yesterday to kind of go in details on some of this. The University of Minnesota is here, and I think can explain some of that question. We're appropriating, so in the fee that's raised, the responsibility that I've discussed is you have the Department of Agriculture that is the lead agency, and we would appropriate the money that's raised to the Department of Agriculture. The change in the policy, and this is part of the policy portion that is in this bill, currently under law, it says the commissioner in conjunction with the University of Minnesota Extension Service. So there's a contract, there's an arrangement, okay, a memorandum of understanding between the Department of Ag and the university. What I'm doing is adding other educational institutions and changing in conjunction to in consultation, so that in addition to the University of Minnesota, you also have the MinSCU system. And when I say other institutions, we had a testimony in the last meeting about working with other land-grant colleges that may have content that's applicable. For example, North Dakota State may have small grains or sugar beet information that's current or that's applicable in Minnesota. Iowa State may have information, or the University of Wisconsin. In the structural pest control world, Purdue is one of the stars in dealing with structural pest control. So the language that I'm changing in the policy part allows the ability to work with other institutions. The responsibility is the Department of Agriculture is to work with those institutions so that we can get the best product available.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. You know, that's helpful to know that we have other avenues to get the programs. But I guess I'm still unclear as to if the when somebody comes to the getting their recertification or licensing, there has got to be somebody, some agency that sets those particular costs for that and has authority to distribute those accordingly. And my question is how does that exactly work? If the Department of Ag sets the policy or sets the fee structure, and it can contract with those other agencies, then why can't they just set the cost to cover the cost of the materials?
Madam Chair, I think this
Representative Hansen.
This would be good if Dean Durgan would maybe come and it's a good. I'll use this as an opportunity to maybe have the university explain exactly how they do this.
Thank you.
If that would be okay.
I think that would likely be helpful. Representative Falk, did you have a question? That otherwise we'll have Dean Durgan give some information.
I think maybe just a clarifying question for Representative Hansen. I think there's some misconceptions about who pays for this. To my understanding, it's not the farmer. It's not our business in rural Minnesota that's selling the product, but it's actually the product manufacturer, i.e. the chemical company. Is that correct?
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair, and in the bill, I think, Representative Falk, you're talking about the bill?
Yes.
Madam Chair and Representative Falk and members, if you look at Section Section 1 and Section 2 describe where the fee is paid now, that goes and that the underlying portion where there's changes to that fee for is to the registrant and to have the ag retailer collect the fee. But that's different than what I think Dean Durgan is going to describe of the status quo right now of who is paying the fee right now for commercial, non-commercial, structural pest control. That's it.
Oh, all right. Well, we have Dean Durgan at the desk. If she would introduce herself, I think the presentation will be enlightening.
Great. Good morning. My name is Bev Durgan. I'm Dean of University of Minnesota Extension. I'm also a professor and an extension weed scientist. So as a weed scientist and a faculty member, I've been involved in pesticide applicators training. Since I've been here in Minnesota, I've been involved in some of the manual development, the exams, and also been very much involved in the research and the education around education around pesticide and weed management in the state. So what I thought I'd do today is try to answer some of the questions that I've heard today and also some that I know that you had last week about what the role of the University of Minnesota is in pesticide applicators training and education. And I do want to stress that the University of Minnesota, what we bring to the table is that research base and the education. And we are involved in the manual preparation, the exam preparation, and the recertification because they have to really go hand in hand. Taking an exam, it shows, as Representative Hansen said, it shows the minimum competency of an applicator, that they know what a pesticide is, they know how to calculate the rates of that pesticide, they know how to make sure that they're safe applying it and the public's safe. But there's also other things that go on to making a decision to apply a pesticide. And the University of Minnesota then plays that role in helping applicators decide, is the pesticide the right thing to do, or should we look at other methods of control? And that is part of the manual development, too, is that, you know, applying a pesticide to control a pest should not always be the first choice. There's other ways of managing pests, and so that's around integrated pest management, say in agriculture or structural. It's also around using different methods of management, and so that's all part of what comes in with developing of the manuals and with the continuing education and the recertification. So I'll just talk a little bit about the university's involvement in both classes, the private pesticide applicator training and then the commercial pesticide applicators training. So the private pesticide applicators training is for people that are applying pesticides that are not for hire, so they're doing it themselves. We have a large number of those people in the state. The University of Minnesota is responsible for developing the manual, and I think some of you have seen the manual. Here it is. It's quite a thick book. And we're also then responsible for developing the exams. The private pesticide applicators manual right here is in print. It's also available online in a PDF form that applicators can download. The exam is available online, so the private applicator can take it online. They can also then mail it in to the Department of Ag. The fee structure around the private pesticide applicators licensing and certification that the University of Minnesota receives to take the exam is $50, and $10 of that goes to the Department of Agriculture for their part of the program, and $40 stays with the University of Minnesota. For recertification, the cost is the same, $50 for an applicator to go to a training for recertification, $10 to the department, $10 to the University of Minnesota. That money that stays at the University of Minnesota is used for manual development, exam development. Again, as Representative Hansard said, that you really need to make sure that you're equilibrating the exams to the manual so that there's not questions on the exam that aren't covered in the manual. That's very important. And also for the recertification, we have over 60 plus training programs for these private applicators through the state, and many of them are the presentations are done by university faculty and maybe people from the outside. So it covers the costs of all those programs, travel to do that. So the private pesticide applicators program is working very well. It's pretty much the cost of it is covered. So let's look at now at the commercial applicators, the non-private. And that is where it gets to be more complicated and where some of the costs really increase that Representative Hansen is talking about. The commercial applicators, there's 25 classes. Some of them are very small and some of them are very large. But some of the very small categories are also some of the most technical categories that they're very specialized, and there's not that many people in the U.S., whether they're University of Minnesota faculty or other faculty, that are experts in the field. And so it takes a little bit, you have to really work with them to get those manuals developed. So with commercial, the University of Minnesota then is responsible for developing the manuals and keeping the manuals up to date. and the Department of Agriculture is responsible for writing the exam. So we don't administer the exams for the commercial part as we do with a little bit different with the private. The funding for the commercial applicators that the University of Minnesota gets to run that program is through the sale of the manuals. So it is the sale of the manuals that is used then to support the additional manual development. And there's a number of ways that we look at developing manuals. So for the 25 different categories that we have, one way is you write a new manual. So there's a new class or there's been so many changes, you write a new manual. And that can take, you know, when we've been writing some new manuals, that can take anywhere from 1 to 3 years. And the reason that it can take so long, again, is to find the specialist to help write it, writers to write it, because, again, these manuals have to be written to a level that the applicators can understand them and also so the exams can be written. And the cost for a manual that, you know, a complicated manual can be up to about $60,000 to get that done. That's just to get the experts, the writers, to get that done. And then the printing and distribution is after that. Another way that we could do a manual is to update the current one that we have. That's much easier. It doesn't take as long, and we've done that. We've also then have worked with other states, as Representative Hansen mentioned, that we've worked with other states to adapt their manuals to the state of Minnesota. That also takes less time, and it costs less. Other states have also taken our manuals, so they'll take our manual. So we try to do the sharing across the land grants to do it. And the third is that we will just use another state's manual, and that is what we've done too with stored grain. There's a nice manual, and I think that one's out of Iowa, that we use their manual, so it meets what we need. So we look at different ways, and by being the university and we're working with other land grants, that we can do that. So again, we look at all different ways. Why would we update a manual? Again, there's many reasons. Changes in law, changes in technology, changes in application type that would make us want to update those manuals. Those manuals are reviewed on a regular basis, and some of them are not updated every year. Some of them do need to be updated on a more regular basis. So again, the cost recovery for the university is through the sale of manuals, and I think you have a copy of what the price of the manuals are. The manuals, and then also the training workshops. We do not do all the recertification workshops for the commercial applicators in the state. We do the majority of those. But again, there's costs with putting those workshops on, you know, location, travel, those things. So when we look at cost recovery for the university, is that we do not receive enough funding to pay for the writing of the manuals and reviewing the manuals. So we've had to look at other ways to do that. And one of the ways we've done it, again, we share across states. Others, we have gone and got written grants and gotten money from national EPA and also from USDA to help write those. So writing grants, getting additional money. Oh, and a question. I'm sorry.
Yes, just to pause there for a second. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for coming. I just have a quick question on the manuals and who's going to pay for them. You said something like the University of Iowa had one that we would get. Are there copyright issues that go on there where, like, the University of Iowa developed this and we take that, now we have to pay them a certain amount for the use of that manual? And if we developed one at the University of Minnesota, would then other states or other groups, when they use our manuals, would there be a copyright fee that would come back to the university?
Dean Durgan.
Chair Poppe, Representative. We have worked those out with other states. We have made some initial payment for using their manuals, and sometimes they use our manuals. So there's not always a cost associated with that. We work out those copyrights, and we also work those out if we're going to develop them for our state. So right now, it has worked pretty well to trade those manuals and not and working out the copyrights between the two states.
Okay, and Representative Anderson.
Wasn't quite ready so quickly. Anyway, thanks, Madam Chair. thanks, Dean, for being here. and I realize we're all getting caught up in a kind of a financial thing in a policy committee, but it sounds like the system is working. And you haven't shared with us, you know, how much the university is losing or it's costing them to do this, but you know, it's working. It's worked since 1989, and does the system need to be fixed or tinkered with?
Dean Durgan.
Representative, I think the issue comes down to, do we want to make the manual and the exam more accessible and easier and take it into the digital age where people want it online? And right now, the costs are being handled. It's not in the commercial. It's not totally being covered by fees. We've had to go out and find grants to get the money to do it. So it's working. But if we were going to put a manual online, and we now have a grant into EPA to revise the aquatic manual and put that online, you know, putting a course online, just so some of our experience that we have an extension like our food safety program, that can take a couple years and up to $50,000 to $60,000. Again, it's not any cheaper to put things online, especially if you want it to be an interactive kind of learning session around that. If you just want to put PDF files up that you can read, that's not expensive. But if you want it to be an interactive manual to really help people to study, that takes a lot more money. So if we were going to move into that age, then we are going to need additional funds to do that.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. So it sounds like the private side of the whole thing is, you know, it's a three-year certification, and you're talking more into the commercial side. Now, I think they have to be relicensed every year. It's a once-a-year type certification for them. And the license fee then is paid to the Department of Ag. I think you said you just sell the manuals on the commercial side. So what are the fee costs for the licenses for the commercial folks?
Dean Durgan.
Chair Poppe, Representative Anderson, you're correct. And I don't know what the fee structure is for the commercial. It does vary between classes. So I would have to get that information to you. That I don't know right off. Sorry about that.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Chairman. If I understand the purpose of this particular bill, it was kind of twofold. One was to develop opportunities for us to gather information and research and booklets from other sources, and the other one was to provide some funding for that. But it sounds like, from what your testimony said, is that you already existent doing that with checking with other states, with other organizations. So apparently that part of the bill is already being taken care of. Is that correct?
Dean Durgan or Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Petersburg. The status quo is that we have been adopting manuals, but the statute hasn't kept up with the status quo. That's one issue. When the university works with other states, they are working in consultation. They work with the other states, but this allows, with the policy that's in House File 151, when we move from the content, from content development, content collaboration, to technology, updating the statute so that it's explicit that the department can be working with the university, other land-grant institutions, and the MNSCU system, so that we can use what we have out there. Right now, the statute doesn't say you can work with the MNSCU system. It doesn't say that you can work with the other institutions. I'm updating the policy so that's explicit, because when you go to this new technology, when you take the content, and the content development takes time, but the technology takes time, that would give us the platform in the change in statute to make sure that that's applicable. So we're now current and applicable to what we're doing.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you for that clarification. And one of the things that I appreciate, Madam Chair, the continuing on with this, but it seems like if we're doing it now, and I don't believe any of us believe that we are abiding outside the law, then the question becomes, then why do we need to to clarify that with the opportunity of, or potential, at least for the future, then of having to come back and refix it. Sometimes policy is better if it's not so specific, because it allows for a lot more discretion and an opportunity to explore new avenues. So I'm curious about us painting ourselves into a corner later on. Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Petersburg. I think the change that's in 151 actually provides more flexibility than current law, because it allows the other institutions explicitly and makes that a more general application. I want to go back to the need. So what Dean Durgan has talked about is it takes time to develop the manual. If we're going to create one from scratch, it takes time, and it takes money. So content development and technology development, by investing in that, we can enhance what we have right now. We have some older manuals, a variety of age of manuals. Updating those so they're current all at one time and making the technology change, then in the long run, should reduce the cost, because you have made the technology jump. So when there are changes to statute or changes to science or changes to technology, we can incorporate those into the manuals instead of incorporating it into the book and having to print out another chapter. Moving from paper to electronic, we can make those changes faster and I think probably cheaper, and update a series of questions on the exam by making that leap. That's going to take money, more money than what we have now in the cost recovery system.
Okay, Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was interested in the comment about the manual that was developed or contracted for after the floods. That was the antimicrobial, I believe. Now, if I understand it right, that the need for that was because we had floods and we had mold in houses. And, of course, houses where kids reside, and I worry about that always. So that flood was in 2007. Then we had a series of floods. Was that manual done in time for the next flood? Maybe I should ask a different way. Was that manual... how long did it take to write that manual?
Dean Durgan.
Chair and Representative Wagenius, I have the manual here, and how long it took to that was published in 2010. So the publication in 2010. And how long it took? We can ask that question from the person, Dean Hertzfeld, who is here in the audience, that can tell us how, if you would like him to answer that question, he could tell you that.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, I think we've got the frame here. I mean, the flood was in 2007, and the manual was ready in 2010. If I remember correctly, we had a flood in between those two times. So having this ability to rapidly respond, I think, is actually quite important. And if this is one that I would, because of the science that's moving so rapidly here, even though it was published in 2010, how often would you review that for update, that particular one?
Dean Durgan or Representative
Hansen. Representative Wagenius. You know, one issue around the manuals is that the manuals are not meant to be a pesticide label. So labels change, new pesticides come in, and that's not part of the manual. The manual is more about how you apply pesticides, when you apply pesticides, and safety. So they don't need to be updated as much as, say, a pesticide label would, you know, as they change, because individual pesticides, classes of pesticides, yes, individual pesticides. But if there is a new class of pesticides that, you know, that it totally changes how you would control mold in a building, then it would have to be changed. I hope that answers it. You know, it's not a set time because, again, you know, it just depends on how the technology, how the research is in that area when the manual needs to be changed.
Representative Wagenius.
Madam Chair, I'm just remembering all the problems we've had with mold in houses, not just from the floods, but from construction. And so having things that work for consumers is really important. I mean, this one, it's important for the consumers among us.
Dean Jurgen, did you have a response?
Yeah.
No.
Chair Poppe, Representative. And again, I think it's important too when we look at the applicator's training, the manual and the recertification, is that it is a full picture about controlling, let's just take mold. It may not be a pesticide that needs to happen there. And so, you know, it is about the full picture of recertification and the manual to help in that education of how to manage that. But I agree with you, it is it's a safety issue for consumers and for applicators as well.
Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dean Durgan, for coming today. I just want to clear up a couple math things in my head. I believe that you said that it cost about $60,000 to generate a new manual. Is that right? Okay. And Representative Hansen, maybe you can answer this. And thank you for taking the time to discuss this with me. Is it my understanding that it's about $500,000 generated each year by this increased fee?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Faust. The number that I had from House Research, and Colby can correct me if I'm wrong here, but when we searched on this, 0.1% would generate about $400,000 annually.
Okay.
That's statewide.
Representative Faust.
Thank you. I also want to check, and I guess Dean Durgan would probably be the one to ask about this. We got a list of the cost of each of the different manuals. Antimicrobial, $42. Some are $31. One of them, $650. Does that cover? Because you said it's $60,000 to develop a new manual, and then printing and distribution is after that. Does this cover the cost of the printing and distribution, or not quite all of it, or is that pretty close as you can get? Where are you at on that?
Dean Durgan,
Chair, Representative. Yes, the cost of the manuals covers the cost of the distribution, printing, and mailing. It does not cover the total cost of updating and revising manuals.
Okay, very good. All right, thank you very much. That's all. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. I want to go back again on the two different classes here, the private and the commercial. And Mr. Sullivan looked up in statute, and in the fee for a commercial certification or recertification is $50. And that entire amount then goes to the Department of Ag, and the only revenue for the university then is the sale of the manual. And on the private side, you know, the breakup is 10 to the Department of Ag and 40 to the university. Mm-hmm. Representative Hansen, could the commercial side be broken up somewhat like the private side to give the university more revenue from that $50 fee? Well, now all the department is doing is the testing and getting the whole $50 fee.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson. The $50 license fee, when you go to the Department of Agriculture, and again, 8 years ago, I supervised the pesticide applicator portion, but you also have the incident response folks, you have the pesticide registration folks, all of the complement of staff that are at the Department of Ag, and the rent and the computers and the program, the travel goes into, it was the pesticide regulatory account when I was there. I think now it's called the agricultural fund at the Department of Ag. We're here, that's into that pool. You have the person taking the who administers the proctored exams at the Department of Agriculture, and you have field staff that also administer the proctored exams. In addition, at every one of the workshops, whether it's the university or the agricultural short course or the turf and ornamental or the structural pest control, you have Department of Agriculture folks there monitoring the workshop to make sure that people are attending the workshop rather than just checking in and disappearing. I think when Representative Faust was an applicator, I made sure that he was there because he might have wandered off a little bit. But so there's all that. That $50 goes into that pool.
Yep.
And my memory may be wrong, but the $40 that the university gets on the private pest applicator, that isn't set in statute. In 1989, I think it was $10, the $10 fee that was there for the Department of Ag. I think the university charged $15, it was $25. So over time, as the number of private applicators has gone down, and we've had the changes in, there's been cost cutting because there are not county extension offices in every county anymore. You've had the regionalization and the sharing of specialists, so you've had cost constriction. But there's also been, for the 17,000 private applicators that are there now, the university has the authority to increase the fee so that they get for the cost recovery, so it's gone up to 40. So the $50 has been there. If you look at what we're doing with the commercial, non-commercial structure, it actually is kind of similar because the university has the ability in charging what they will for the manuals and charging what they will for the workshops. The piece that's missing here is that content development, quality assurance, and the technology leap that's there to make sure that the we can do this into the future and keep updating. I don't know if that answers your question, but it goes into that pool that is in the regulatory. And I want to correct something that I said at the last meeting. We used to cost code by every, so when I was a supervisor and I spent time on a private applicator program, I would cost code my time to that program. And if I spent it on the structural, I'd code my time to the structural. I code it to the each piece, and I was informed by the Department of Ag that they do not do that anymore.
Representative Anderson.
Just a final, I guess, comment then. You mentioned, Representative, that currently the bill calls for the five-year fee and talked offline possibly of shortening that period, but it seems like we never like to give up on a tax or a fee once we have it. And this is, if this is really needed, this is kind of a one-time fix, and if we're looking at a short time period, and as technology changes as rapidly as it does, are we going to be back in 3 or 5 years doing the same thing again if we need to update and continue to do that, and yet this is just a one-time fix?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson. I'm looking at it as a one-time investment to update, and when we make that technology change, that should reduce the costs in the out years, because you have moved from paper. You've moved from paper to the electronic version, so you can make those changes in content more quickly than in the past. So if we have a new product that comes on the market, an antimicrobial, and it's there, we can make that change without having to go back and recreate the paper manual again and take a couple years to do it. We can make those changes faster when we move our current portfolio of manuals into the digital age. I want to make one other thing here where I think there's a change in some of the applicators as well. Now, as we're all getting older, we've been used to paper. You know, we like to have the paper, we like to look at the book, but some of these applicators that are coming in that are 18, 19, or 20, they're used to tech, they're used to the iPad, they're used to the electronic versions, and so there's more fluency in that. And in addition, there's that opportunity with other languages or to provide that measurement of competency, so we're assured that the applicators can demonstrate that. So I think we can do that. I think we can, and I don't I want to be clear again. I don't intend for this to go on in perpetuity. I want it to be updated, and then that should reduce the cost in the long run.
All right. Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I had one thought. The manuals we saw at our last hearing are well done. They look very nice. Must be expensive print and so forth, and to redo and update. My thought was, has there been any consideration to changing the format so you use more of a loose-leaf binder, something that updates could be easily attached to and sections could be removed? Is there any thought to a different format when you're using the printed material? I understand the electronic part. I think that's the direction everyone is moving these days. But when it comes to the printed manuals, has there been any consideration or cost benefit to that? So the updates would be rather inexpensive without having to reprint everything.
Dean Durgan.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have looked at other formats, and we have looked at different ways of printing and how to distribute these manuals. Actually, printing costs have gone down a lot, so that the cost of printing is not the major cost. One of the problems we have with three-ring binders and changing information in that is trying to keep them updated when they're out in distribution. You know, the private pesticide applicator's license is still available at all the county offices. So when you have an update, there are manuals in distribution and to keep those updated. And it is a personnel issue, too, is that at our warehouse, you go in through all the three-ring binders and change them. So it can happen, but it is that, it's that quality control. Was this an updated one? Was this not? And then if the exam was changed because of the update, did the applicator have the right one? So it is around trying to make sure that there's quality control and the applicators have the right information.
Representative Hamilton.
Madam Chair, my question is for the Department of Agriculture, okay. So until we're done with question with Dean Durgan, I can wait.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Petersburg.
This is probably just more of a point, but I heard earlier that we talked about that this this tax is actually going to be on the wholesaler, the manufacturer itself. But I want to remind us that it doesn't really matter where in the chain of commerce that it comes. The final payer is the consumer. Just as in gasoline tax, that is collected at the wholesale level. But I don't think anybody here believes that it's not part of the cost of gasoline that we pay for. So my concern is why do we make it so complicated and not just make it part of the application fee and registration cost to cover the cost of our program? It seems to me it would be safer. It would automatically always adjust to the needs of the program and wouldn't require coming back to this body all the time. Just my clarification.
All right. Any other questions for Dean Durgan? Otherwise, thank you.
Thank you
for your testimony. And the Department of Ag, Representative Hansen, you have someone who's going to be available to answer questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that Ms. Gauthier's father went into surgery today, so I know she's not here today. That was a fairly short notice. So I was anticipating there would be backup, but I do not see them here.
Representative Hamilton, do you want to ask your question to see if...
Just for the record, and first of all, thoughts and prayers are with Ms. Gauthier. I mean, without a doubt. We left the department with some questions to ask them to bring that information back here today. And under the circumstances, of course, that's concerning. With Ms. Gauthier. However, it's disappointing that there wasn't somebody else that could come in and ask or answer those questions. I mean, a lot of the decisions that we're trying to make is based off the information that we're getting here from the department. When we're talking about listening to some of the comments that were made around all the questioning, we hear a lot about that, there's cost share going on. We're writing grants. We're getting grants. The quote was, it's working. You know, there's some uncertainty taking place right now with the governor's budget on broadening sales tax, and some concerns that many are talking about in the ag industry is that agriculture will lose tax-exempt status, driving up the cost of food. And here we're talking about a bill that increases the tax on ag inputs. There is some uncertainty about the need, if you will, we're hearing comments, like I said, that it's working. I'm going to encourage a no vote on this, and I'm going to ask for a roll call.
All right, a roll call has been requested, so that will happen when the vote is taken. This bill is the next stop would be the Finance Committee. The Environment, Ag, Natural Resources Finance Committee. Representative Hansen, do you have any other comments? Or?
Well, I think I know there are various stakeholders in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if any of them want to make a comment or not. I know the Nursery and Landscape Association had sent an email that I think is in your packet earlier. Maybe if I don't know if anyone wants to make a comment.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to come down and provide some testimony? And we do have someone. So if you would please state your name for the record and provide your testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Bill Bond. I represent the Minnesota Crop Production Retailers. Our members are the folks that provide the crop inputs and are also the certified crop advisors that provide advice to the producers of the state. And I want to thank Representative Hansen for his interaction with us as we've had questions and trying to understand more about the process. I think we've all learned a bit more about how the first certification and then the recertification of applicators is, and it's much more complex than I think I even looked at when we were thinking of just the ag part of the process. I was anticipating the department would be here, but I do have, and I apologize, but I do have three collated but unstapled sheets that show the pesticide fees across the upper Midwest, and if somebody had a question that might be useful to them, my summary of that is that the pesticide fees in Minnesota and Wisconsin are one of the higher ones already in the upper Midwest. That being said, we have, I think, a very robust program. We work very closely with the Department of Agriculture, with the University of Minnesota Extension, and as a matter of fact, we have experience in certification ourselves because working together with Bev Durgan and University and USDA, and of course the Department of Agriculture, we also certify certified crop advisors, and the industry is interested not only in the minimal certification, which is what this is, the basic understanding, but the companies that produce the equipment and the chemical companies and the co-ops, ag retailers, go to their own expense to see that beyond the minimal certification, there is good quality training provided. When you get into precision ag and some of the site-specific application of inputs, it becomes rather sophisticated, and we're working very diligently to see that the training is ongoing. And of course, when we bring on new products or when we change product specification, the label is the law. That's what the industry's code is. So that's how we really address those updates. And when it relates to training, the basics is how do you read the label, and of course, that is the law. Related to our own thoughts about this, we're not speaking for or against the bill particularly, just wanted to make sure you had some additional information. Just a quick survey of our members. Most folks would really rather have the manual. It's looking at something on a screen is a little tedious for some, but I do agree with Representative Hansen that digitizing is where things are going to be going in all industries, and as young people come along, we see that trend. So I think that's appropriate. From our perspective, we think the process is working very well, and yet we're learning about it too. The ag applicators, the one last point I want to clarify, about 2 years ago, 2010, we and this is to the financing part, and forgive me, but there's been so much discussion, I might as well clarify the policy end of it as well. And that is that with our request in the industry as a whole, we changed the registrant payment of the fee to the ag retailer, to the dealer, if you will, and we did that for a number of reasons, but we wanted that to cover everybody that provides inputs to the producers in this state. Some of the border states, we found there was collection issues trying to get the fees in, and so it created an unlevel playing field, if you will. So when it relates to ag retailers, the law reads that the retailer collects the fee, not the registrant, and that fee goes on the invoice by law. So any change in that part of it, which is what this bill would do, adding that additional tenth of a percent for the 5 years of the temporary increase, that will go on every invoice every farmer pays in pesticides for the next 5 years. I just wanted to let you make sure that I don't want you to be surprised about that. But with that, I'd be happy to stand for questions, and thank you for the time.
All right. Any questions for Mr. Bond? Ooh, Mr. Bond.
Thank you.
I will tell you, he did give us an 8-page piece of information. So it actually is being passed along as just an 8-page. So you have to keep it together. So to be able to review it, if you want copies, we can have Arlen make copies. But it's kind of
no,
it's different. It's but whatever. Okay. Anybody have any other? Yes, Representative Anderson. Did you have a? Oh, we have. All right.
Madam Speaker, or Madam Chair, I mean.
Yes.
I'd like to welcome Tom Peterson back to the Capitol. I know that your son Dylan has been sick for a while. I've heard he's doing better, and I hope that he's doing well. But I wanted to welcome you back.
Thank you, Representative Faust, and certainly welcome back, Mr. Peterson. So if you can just go ahead and introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Faust. Thank you, members. And my son is doing much better, and thank you for those of you that called or wished us well. It was very helpful. In the meantime, I've been trying to catch up on this bill, but I've been, you know, thinking about it quite a bit and trying to visit with some of our members. And we actually have our president's meeting on Saturday, and we had it on the agenda to discuss it then. But we did a phone call about it with some of our members that do work with application on more of a where they run their own business, doing some application and everything. And they weren't totally opposed to the bill. And so I do urge you to, you know, consider moving forward. And after listening to the university and hearing the technology part was brought up to us too, that you know, and listening to that today, and we have an opportunity to do that, I think we should be looking at that. And I think that it is changing, and our policy does support, you know, strong education components for pesticides and application. And I think that in talking with Representative Hansen, you know, he has been willing to work considerably with the bill. I've been glad that there's a sunset provision on the fee structure, and also hearing him talk about the fee, you know, being adjusted and looking at it quite a bit. And so, I'm comfortable with it and urge your consideration. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Any questions? Yes, Representative Anderson.
I'm a day late and a dollar short. I had a question for Mr. Bond again, if he could step down. And just a comment, when he talked about how this fee would be invoiced, I think now when we get a bill for fertilizer, for example, that the groundwater tax shows up as something that we as farmers pay. So are you saying that this fee would show up on an invoice to a farmer is something he would pay, and then it's backed off and eventually gets back to the chemical company, or how would that be worked?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, what we have changed is the collection point. So the collection point for agriculture is the ag retailer, the dealer. So it's it's put on the invoice that of the crop input or the pesticide to the farmer, and the farmer pays that, and then the retailer remits that to the state. So the I think that's the change that we wanted to see a couple of years ago.
Representative Hansen.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, and part of the reason why that was done at that collection point was because of internet sales. Right. And so there were registrants that were directly selling into the state at it, and then our local retailers had a competitive disadvantage on the fee. So by requiring that the collection point, if they were selling into the state, we're getting a little far afield from the from the applicator, but to make sure that there was a level playing field for the applicators, for our local folks, that's where that was changed, to make that definition of the dealer. If a registrant is selling into the states, everybody would be treated the same. If you look at section 2, for the lawn care applicators, everything else, and Representative Hamilton, I too have been asking for some information to show how much does the ag sector pay, how much does the turf sector pay, how much does all the other stuff pay in terms of the registrants. And I think that's really a key thing for the Finance Committee, because they pay at the registration. If you're Jimmy's Lawn Care Company that sells 2,4-D, Jimmy's 2,4-D, you're paying as the registrant to sell that in the state. So I'm hopeful in the Finance Committee we will have that kind of breakdown on breaking down the registration so you can see that. And I think that can help adjust where it's needed for the fee to cover the cost.
Representative Anderson.
But again, as it pertains to this proposed piece of legislation, where will that fee show up, and who will eventually pay it?
Madam Chair and
Representative Hansen.
Anderson, the bill as it's written right now, that for the non-ag, the registrant pays it. For the ag, it will show up on the invoice as 1/10 of 1%. Whether it's internet sale or whether it's at a physical location.
Any other questions? Well, Representative Hansen, you have presented us with a bill that has generated a great deal of questions. The questions seem to be related to the financing of it. This is a policy committee. Yes, Representative Hamilton.
I'm sorry. You know, it's we talk a lot about the finance, but it's the policy around all this. You know, it's of course it's where the dollars or how the dollars are being generated, and that's the policy portion of it. So I think it's relevant to have those questions answered here as well. I'm questioning the policy around it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. I was in the stream of getting. I was in the stream of getting to that, actually. So I appreciate the nudge. All right, because there are a number of questions, I'm sure that Representative Hansen would like to see this move on to the Finance Committee so that the finances can be answered. But I actually concur with Representative Hamilton and his position that some of those issues need to be dealt with here. And I So I'm actually going to do something that I wasn't initially intending to do, but I'm going to once again lay this bill over just because I think that the Department of Ag, I actually have a question for them. I think that others may have some questions. And although I know Representative Hansen would appreciate this moving along a little bit quicker, I do think that in light of the fact that we don't have somebody from the Department of Ag here today and we do have a few questions surrounding that, I would just prefer to lay it over. I'm not sure that tomorrow is going to be the day that we'll have somebody here to be able to answer those questions. But what I would suggest to the author is that I can certainly let him know what my question is. I think that maybe you'd want to speak again with Representative Hamilton just to, again, be reminded about what those questions are so that when the department comes back, they'd be able to just address those, and then we'd be able to see. And I think Representative Anderson may have some additional questions. It just appears as such. So that is going to be what I'm going to do at this point. So lay that over, House File 151, and it likely is going to be next Wednesday, so a week from today. So just be aware of that, and that's the situation.
Madam Chair, I just want to again address that the jurisdiction of this committee is policy.
I understand that. I would agree, and but as I said, I think it's some of this is wrapped up together, and that's I'm going to make that decision. So we can talk about that later, I'm sure. But I the other thing that we have today. So I appreciate Representative Hanson, certainly Dean Durgan and others who came today. Appreciate that. I know this is taking an amount of time, and I just want to thank you for coming. But we do have a legislative district commercial show and tell from. Representative McNamer today.
That's our
PowerPoint. Yes, exactly.
This will not be a PowerPoint.
It will not be a PowerPoint, but it will require some power. So, so once again, just as a reminder. Oh, and he's got a visual about his district. So wonderful. So if we would just draw our attention to Representative McNamer, who is going to give his district presentation.
My name is Jay McNamer. I was born and raised in western Minnesota. My parents were farmers. My wife's parents are farmers. This is a good fit for me. I have moved from where I was born down south. I was trying to get to Florida. This is far south. And I ended up in an area that is very diverse. And the reason it's diverse, my district is because of the last glacier that was here and melted and receded. On the eastern half of my district, and you can see it here on this map, it's loaded with water. Small lakes, small ponds. If you get up in an airplane and fly over this area, you would be amazed at how much water there is there. It's good for wildlife. It's also good for small farms. As you go to the west, and you hit my city, which is Elbow Lake, and you go about 5 more miles further west, you start running into what the remains of Lake Agassiz. Lake Agassiz left a large, flat, level area with some of the best agricultural land in the nation, if not the world. And to me, it's absolutely beautiful. Flat, no trees, you can see for 10 miles. Well, maybe not 10 months. You can see for a long way. So if you'd follow along with me, and I'll just quickly go over what the geographic features are. First of all, my district's about 3,645 square miles. It's big. It's located in the west central part of the state. The east side is composed, again, mostly smaller lakes. The west side is large, flat areas, which are great for farming. On the west side, we have two main bodies of water. We have Lake Traverse, which leads into the Boise de Sioux, which leads into the Red River that flows north to Winnipeg, up into Hudson Bay. And then south of that, there's the Minnesota River leads into Big Stone Lake, which eventually leads down to the Mississippi, which leads into the Gulf of Mexico. There's a divide there. There's a small area right between Lake Traverse and Big Stone Lake. That area is called Browns Valley. It's kind of a unique area. It's about, and Andy can correct me, I think it's about 5 miles in distance that separates those two lakes. What I've done is this. I broke this down. Agriculture by far is the main industry in my district. But there are hundreds of small little businesses. And that's a thing to be aware of. Now, I'm going to start on the west side. I want to start with Wilkin County. Wilkin County's population is about 6,600 people. The average size of the farm is about 1,025 acres. Those farms are large. The average age of the farmer, when I found this out, I was surprised because I thought the average age would be older than what it is. It's 51 years of age. Those are my former students that are farming this, so I think they're fairly young. The crops there are soybeans, corn, sugar beets, and wheat. There's a small amount of dairy and beef cattle. There's nine communities in Wilkin County, Breckenridge being the largest. Breckenridge is about 3,500 people, and it's also the county seat. As we keep going on down south, on the west side, again, we're still in the bottom of Lake Agassiz. We're on the south end of the Red River Valley. We come to Traverse County. Traverse County is not quite as populated. We have about 3,500 people. The average size of the farm is about 761 acres. The crops there are soybeans, corn, and wheat. Again, livestock and poultry make up about 9% of the total ag products there. So it's not very important. It's important, but not very large. Let me change that. There's four communities, Wheaton being the largest, and Wheaton's about 12 to 14. It's about 1,400 people. As we keep going down further, the next county down is Big Stone.
Representative McNamer?
Yeah.
Just before you move on to Big Stone, I believe Representative Anderson. See, now we're getting into this. We're going to be grilling the people. So
well,
just
that's okay.
Be prepared.
I've been used to that.
Okay, Representative Anderson.
These figures are great, Representative. And when I did mine, the latest figures I could find were 2007, 2008. So when you'd give average age of a farmer, how current are those
2011.
Figures?
2011.
Okay.
Is the most recent ones that I got. So.
Great. Thanks for
so,
the question.
And, you know, Mr. Anderson, Representative Anderson, I was surprised, too, because I remember the average age of farmers in my area was, like, 61, 62 years of age. And these are fairly young ages. So in retrospect, are we seeing a turn? We could be. Okay, let's go on. Big Stone. Big Stone has a population of about 5,269 people. It has 400 farms. 15 of these farms are dairy farms, 25 raise hogs, 35 farms have beef cattle. The crops there are wheat, soybeans, corn, and alfalfa. And again, we're getting more into it, the beef cattle and dairy products there. There are granite quarries in Big Stone, and there's eight communities, Ortonville being the largest. Ortonville is about 2,200 people. If you've ever been to Ortonville, it's unique because it's not flat like the other parts. It's up and down. And part of it has to do because of the Big Stone Lake, which is part of the Minnesota River. Going to the east now, we come to the county that I live in, Grant County. Grant County's population is about 6,000 people. The average size of the farm is about 5,200. It's about 524 acres. The average age of the farmer is 54. The crops there are soybeans, corn, sugar beets, wheat, and edible beans. Again, livestock and poultry and dairy make up about 10% of the market. And so it's not a very big part of our area. As we go down to Stevens County, and you'll notice there's going to be a change here. Stevens County's population is about 9,700 people. The average size of the farm starts to get smaller. They're about 563 acres. The average age of the farmer is 52. The crops are corn, soybeans, and wheat. But livestock, poultry, and dairy make up about 48% of the ag market. If I believe if you go south, Mr. Anderson can help you on this. If you go south of Herman and Hancock, we run into some larger dairy farms. And Representative Anderson and I were talking at Farm Bureau, and I think I was told there's about 40,000 head of dairy cattle down there. Am I right on that?
Representative Anderson.
Yeah, there's some good sized dairy operations south of Morris and in that area. Yeah.
When I heard that, I was actually surprised. I didn't realize how big it was. The other thing about Stevens County is that it's the home of the University of Minnesota Morris, one of the best liberal arts colleges in the nation. It's been referred to the Ivy League School of West Central Minnesota. And we have a good core of students, is academically great, and it's something that I'm proud of for my district. Also in Stevens County, we have the West Central School of Agriculture and Experiment Station. And we also have something called Superior Industries. And that's probably one of our largest companies in my district. It was founded on building conveyor belts. They've expanded. They have a number of different companies. They bought out Hancock Concrete, which makes cement pipes for storm sewers and sewers. It employs a lot of people. It's a good industry. There's five communities in Stephen County, Morris being the largest. Morris is about 5,200 people. But of that 5,200 people, 2,000 are probably college students. I do have two counties on the very eastern part that are partial counties for me. Douglas County, if you see the population, it is 35,000. That most of that's not in my district. Most of it's further to the east. I do not have the city of Alexandria. That's one reason why. But again, take a look at the size of the farms here. Remember, this area, a lot of water here. The average size of the farms are about 232 acres. The average age is 55. Crops are soybeans, corn, wheat, vegetables, and orchards. Livestock, poultry, and dairy products make up 52% of the total ag market. We do have a lot of resorts in this area, and some big-time resorts. One of the unique resorts that I can think of is Andes Towers, which is a ski resort. In my district, we have five communities. Evansville being the largest, Evansville is about 600 people. And then the last part of my district happens to be Hope County. Again, Hope County is about 11,000 people, but not all of it is in my district. In fact, a small part of it is. The average size there is about 379 acres for the farm. Average age of the farmers are 53 years of age. I could ask Representative Anderson what his age is, but I'm not going to.
I heard the answer.
Okay. The crops there are, again, soybeans, corn, wheat. And here's what surprised me. There's about 2,792 acres of vegetables. And you know what? I have not seen that. Mr. Anderson, do you have any idea where that is found in Polk County?
Representative Anderson.
Yeah, in the eastern part of the county, in my part of the district, there's a vegetable processing plant, and there's a lot of sweet corn, peas, things like that grown in the part of the county.
And that was not in my part. So, again, in Polk County, livestock, poultry, and dairy products make up about 43% of the total egg market. There's three communities in my district, Starbuck being the largest, and Starbuck is about 1,400 people. Points of interest, I'd like you to take a look down here. One of the oldest known human remains is found between Big Stone Lake and Lake Traverse. It's found in Browns Valley, and it's known as Browns Valley Man. The remains used to be in the museum in Elbow Lake, but they're no longer there. In Douglas County also, we have the finding of the rune stone, which might be an indication that the Vikings were here before Columbus was. And we don't know if that's right or not. Point of interest, Dwight and Jean, Representative Jean Wagenius, have a farm in Douglas County. And Douglas County, all my district, is the most active in the state for earthquakes. We've had four earthquakes.
Wow.
Yeah, that's right. We've had four earthquakes in the last 38 years. 1975 was the largest, 4.7. And we had consecutive earthquakes in 93, 94, and 95. And they were all around four. There are two people in Grant County that have earthquake insurance on their homes. I'm one of them. And I don't know if that's good or bad. So there are some areas of concern. We have a gentleman by the name of Steve Ellis. He's a beekeeper. He has a large bee operation. 60% of his bees died this winter. What caused it? We're not sure. But that is a concern. And I think it's a concern nationwide. Andy's Tower. I talked about the ski resort. It's in financial trouble. I don't know what we're going to do about that. There is a drought. When I was door knocking this year, and I'm always looking at farmland when I drive around, in the fall I noticed large areas, large fields that were still black. And I couldn't figure out why. I was thinking maybe they changed farming practices. And no, there was not enough moisture for any growth. So hopefully the moisture we got late in the fall, in November, in December, and the snow we've had, and I don't know if that'll help, but it help, hopefully it will help alleviate some of the drought problems we have. There are a couple other concerns, and I don't know if this belongs here or not. We have a number of nursing homes in my district. Those nursing homes are the biggest industry in a lot of our small communities. Those workers haven't had a raise in 4 years. We need to help them out if we can. And it's not just the nursing homes. It's all human health care providers that are hurting. And if you're in a small community like all mine are, that's a big economic thing for Main Street. It's something we've got to help everybody out with. I could have been a farmer. I was asked if I wanted to start with my father-in-law. This was in the late 60s. I said no. And there's a reason why. In the 70s, we had the best time ever. I also remember the 80s, which was the worst time. And whenever I talk to any farmer organization, here's what I tell them. I remember the 70s. It's just like it is now. High yields, the best prices ever. But I remember the 80s. And you know what? That's farming. It's up and down. It's a gamble all the time. Anyone who's a farmer, I take my hat off here, because you know what? It's a tough profession. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative McNamer. All right. There's nothing further before the committee today, so meeting adjourned.